And it's carried on, by the way, into the entire world. As the exploitation of the third world expands, so does the government functions, so does the size of the government that rules, from a principality to a nation to a confederation until finally to a global international network of counterinsurgency right-wing client states to extract labor from the third world at a rate, by the way, which is 2 and 3 times more exploitative than it is here in the United States. And you can understand why capital goes abroad. It's better to employ assemblers of transistors in Taiwan, women in the factory, or in South Korea, where you work them 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, one Sunday off a month, and you pay them something like $12, $15 a week. It's better than to employ people in Ohio to do that sort of thing. And you can sell it for pretty much the same price. Your profits are much bigger. They don't go there, by the way, to give you a lower price. They don't do all that to save you money. They go there to make more profits.
You're listening to Michael Parenti on capitalism. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website alternativeradio.org.
So the struggle is not only in this country. The struggle between labor and capital is throughout the world. It's in El Salvador, it's in Nicaragua, it's in just about every one of these countries you want to name. Again, this leads us to think about another thing, which is the myth of gradualism. The idea that the gains and the improvements and the advances that have been made in this country have been because democratic capitalism, as some writers have insisted, is a system which gradually goes along and opens things up and is creative and allows and actually creates these reforms. Well, it's really very distorting to credit capitalism with reforms which in fact the capitalists resisted tooth and nail, which were shoved down their throats, which were carried out despite their wishes, and which in many cases they then benefited from in certain ways later on, and reforms which are needed because of social problems which they created. It's some joke to credit somebody with reform when he's created the problem. But there have been reforms, and this is the point to be made. That struggle created procedural democracy as well as substantive democracy. The democratic forces in this country, the workers, the laborers, the small farmers, the minorities, the women who fought for their rights, that is the essence of democracy. And to the extent that life today is at all bearable for us and humane for us, to the extent that we are not ground to pieces, it's because of those democratic forces, because they can't go just so far. To the extent that we can argue today, the fact that I can sit up here and speak to you is not because this system of democratic capitalism, so-called democratic, gave me that right. They never gave us anything. We had to extract those rights from them. And I'm sitting up here because of people and generations before who fought for years for free public education, so I, as a son of an immigrant and a poor worker, could go to school and even go to college and get some fellowships. That's how I did it. I didn't do it on my own initiative. There was a whole social system. There was no such thing, ladies and gentlemen, as individual initiative and individual accomplishment in a vacuum. There are millions of other people who came before you. And when you go down that ski slope and you see how great you go, remember, there were people who designed those skis, there were people who built those slopes, who made that equipment, who made the stuff you're wearing. You are engaging in a social activity. There's almost nothing that isn't a social activity. And that freedom of speech, which I have, is only because people fought for that freedom against Pinkertons and goons and county sheriffs. 40 years ago, a talk like this would have been barricaded, and those goons would have been coming in here with their deputies, and we've all been arrested in certain towns, maybe Boulder for one of them, or certainly in towns in Colorado, or during the free speech fights of the Wobblies in the 1920s. So the rights that we have are because of the power that we have. And they make us think differently. They make us think that freedom and power are two things which are antithetical. No. It's only when the people have power and can reclaim some of that power, to the extent that we can reclaim that, then they have the freedom. And so I have the freedom to speak here tonight. People of my persuasion do not have the freedom to speak on ABC or NBC or CBS. George will. George Will has that freedom because he went to the right prep school and he enunciates. The prep school doesn't mean anything. I went to Yale, big deal. But it's that he enunciates the views of that ruling class interests. He gets up there and he doesn't go beyond a certain line. And when those reporters and media commentators say, we're free to say what we want, they're free to say what they want just as long as others like what they say. I mean, they can say what they like as long as others like what they say, that is, those who employ them. That's where the freedom goes. Our persuasion is yet not free to speak and be heard on the networks because the people have not yet fully challenged or in fact had access to that area of power and wealth, which is undemocratic. When Colonel George Mason got up at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 and he said, let's have a Bill of Rights. That proposal was voted down unanimously. It was voted down unanimously. James Madison voted it down too. It was only after he saw the turmoil that was going on over the issue and he got some letters from Jefferson urging him to think otherwise from Paris that he changed his mind and introduced the Bill of Rights. The idea that the framers of the Constitution, called the Founding Fathers, gave us this Bill of Rights is very misleading and very wrong. The Bill of Rights was voted down unanimously by those men of wealth and affluence, the big merchants, the landowners, the shippers, the bankers, and the manufacturers who sat in Philadelphia in 1787. It was only their fear of the democratic forces. It was only their fear that perhaps this Constitution would not get ratified that made them finally make the concession and make the pledge that in the first Congress they would introduce 10 amendments and or whatever it was, I think it was originally 12, whatever, but would institute a Bill of Rights. It was only then that the believers in real democracy, but the men of wealth and affluence distrusted democracy. They feared it. And in the 1820s and 1830s, when workers who were disfranchised agitated for the vote, they weren't given the vote. They won it through agitation and struggle and conflicts, many of which bordered on the violent, many of which were violent. And it was then that the elites in the states like Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and New York got together in their state conventions and opened up the franchise to universal manhood suffrage. And women were never given the vote. You were never given the vote. It was that your sisters from generations before agitated and they got spit at and they got garbage thrown at them and some of them died of pneumonia in prisons and they were force-fed and they were humiliated and they fought and fought and fought and it just took a mere 100 years and they got the vote, right? That's the gradualism that responds to a new need and gives, oh, sure, here you are. It takes enormous struggle to forcibly extract these concessions, these democratic concessions from a plutocracy, an oligarchy that distrusts and hates and fears democracy in its heart, which will use democracy when it can buy the elections, when it can have the affluent candidates. And you were never given the eight-hour day. It was fought for by labor. And most of the free speech was fought for by labor. It was the working people in this country that settled the issue of the First Amendment. As late as the 1920s, in most communities, the sheriff could arrest any labor agitator he wanted, hit him over the head and throw him in jail, shove castor oil down his throat if he wanted. And it was the Wobbly Free Speech Act. It was thousands of men and even some women coming along, riding the rails, coming into a town, taking it over for days and giving all the speeches they wanted, agitating and agitating and exercising free speech because they understood something which those who preach to us, the apologists of the system, don't understand today, which is that the best way to preserve your freedom and your rights is to exercise them vigorously. As with the physical body, so with the body politic. Our freedoms, our democracy is strongest when we exercise it and extend it. And so it is with any gain that the democratic forces have made. Social Security, child labor laws, unemployment insurance, minimum wage laws, all these things, capitalism cannot be credited with that because the rulers resisted those things. With divisions among the ruling class, with some saying, look, give them a little bit so we can keep a lot, and others saying, no, no, you give them a little, you'll open the floodgates and we'll be inundated, but we must hold firm, and the more liberal capitalists winning out on many issues, and the conservatives winning out on many other issues. Now, what capitalists do with this enormous surplus value that they accumulate is several things. One, they reinvest the bulk of it to make yet more money for themselves. Two, they use a very handsome amount of it for personal consumption. The DuPonts, contrary to the myth that they live frugally, the DuPonts have 24 estates in the state of Delaware alone, which pretty well takes up the state of Delaware when you think about it. It's really... Three, they live off it in leisure. There are about 3 or 4 million families in America that live off the labor of others that don't work. And I think it's counted up to 6 or 7 million individuals, quite a few, who live without working, although they fiercely reject any suggestion that they do so. They do. And four, they use a lot of their surplus capital to gain political influence through direct occupancy of public offices. And by the way, every person who has been elected president of the United States since Warren Harding, I'd say, with the possible exception of Harry Truman, has been a millionaire either when he went into the White House or by the time he left the White House. They're all either millionaires or close to it. And as for Congress, we know what the power of the moneyed interest is there. Will Rogers said it, Congress is the best that money could buy. And also, in another way, a far more profound way, not just in the instrumental way of buying policies and buying politicians and all that, the capitalist state itself is wedded to its system. There's really not much it could do without regard for the health of the economy. But the health of the economy is the health of the capitalist economy. And high productivity, maintaining high levels of profits, these kinds of things, are the goals of the corporations, the banks, and these are the goals of the government, really. That is, the whole system itself exerts an influence which is certainly as powerful and permeating as any one oil lobby might be on the Hill. And they do something else with a lot of their surplus value. Most brilliantly, perhaps, were the Rockefellers, but others too. The Carnegies did this, the Vanderbilts, some others. And that is to use a portion of it to gain cultural dominance and cultural hegemony, to create and control the institutions of the United States, the colleges, the universities, the schools, the art, the medicine. It was Gramsci, Antonio Gramsci, the great Italian communist, who made the point that the state is only the first line of defense for the capitalist ruling class. And behind that first line is a whole network of trenches and fortresses which socialize people into a kind of mentality and into a perspective which buttresses the power and force of the state. One could not rule by bayonets alone. So, for instance, today we could see how that kind of consciousness gets permeated, and people will say to you, I heard a steel worker interviewed on TV just the other night, he said, yeah, Reagan's good for the rich, but I don't care because when the rich get richer, there's more jobs for me. That is, he has learned the central myth of capitalism, which is that it's the capitalist who produces wealth and brings it to you and gives you a little of it. All he asks back is for you is your labor, you see. Or when people reject socialism, it's not because they don't like the brotherhood of socialism. It's because they believe and they've been taught and they've been told, and it often proves to be true and functional in this society, that you got to be selfish. And that's part of human nature. So they don't believe it would work. And they think that socialism would be even worse because it would be so, so bad, etc. I want to close this talk, draw toward the end of it, by mentioning something about Reaganism and Reaganomics. I maintain that Reaganism is not a foolish thing, and I maintain that Reagan isn't stupid. He does all the right things for the class that he so faithfully and skillfully represents. He commits gaffes at press conferences, he forgets names, he doesn't know details of anything and all that sort of thing, but he understands the thing we've been talking about tonight. And he understands that the function of The state is to protect the interests of the ruling class, and the primary interest of the ruling class is to maintain its margin of profits. And the way you do that is the way we talked about before. You drive down wages. And the way you drive down wages is you cheapen the price of labor. You diminish labor's ability to fight back. You break unions. And the NLRB has been handing down some remarkable decisions. And 30% of this economy, labor force used to be unionized. It got down to 25, then 22, then 20, now 18, and now close to 16% as unions are being broken. Two, you increase the supply of cheap labor supply by having more people out on the market. You do that by, for instance, raising the retirement age. You reduce minimum wage, as we say. You turn back affirmative action. One of the things that the historical role that women and minorities have always played is to be a reserve army of labor, of cheap labor. If you've got that pool of cheap labor out there, then you can always hire them and deflate wages for other people, you see. And a very interesting development is taking place in Washington, D.C. today, where you have AFSCME unions going out on strike in support of the women for equal pay, because they've suddenly discovered that when the women in their company are paid lower, that's a drag on their own wages. So they're now talking about affirmative action and equal pay for everybody, that everybody's a worker together. So you see how the fight that women launch for themselves can have a progressive effect on men. Another thing historically done is you deny labor alternative sources of sustenance. The enclosure acts of the late 18th century are the classic development of capitalism in that way. Goldsmith's heart-wringing poems about the death of the British peasantry. When the peasants had alternative sources of sustenance, they had the commons where they could get game, fruit, they could grow some things, they get firewood, they could sustain themselves at a poverty level. When the enclosure acts came and cut the commons off, that was starvation for the English peasantry. And it was deliberately done to send them into the hellholes of Manchester, Lancashire, and London, places like that, to go work in the factories. It created a proletariat. People are not born as workers. They had to be forcibly created to learn to work 8 hours a day in that way. And so later on in the late 18th century, when the workers went out strike, in many of the great strikes of the 1870s, 1880s in the United States, one of the few things that sustained them was their garden plots in the back. So they started building tenements without gardens. First, more money for the landlord, pile more human beings in there. And second, they have no more access to food. And the whole essence of capitalism is to cut off alternative accesses, to make you dependent on them for food, for energy, for transportation, for forms of recreation, even for the images that you get in your head and the culture that we no longer create because it's fed to us over electronic media, you see. And so with today, Reagan systematically is cutting off alternative sources of sustenance. He attacks unemployment insurance. He attacks AFDC, aid to families with dependent children. He attacks Social Security and disability through more stringent interpretations. Hundreds of thousands of workers who were collecting disability have been cut off. They have forced them to go back on the market to compete. He wants to attack, and he attacks welfare, as I say, the AFDC. He made a very revealing comment. He said, the poor are the only people who don't have to move when they're out of a job. Let them go move. Let them go off where there's a promise of a market. Let them all flood over to where those jobs are, so they can cheapen the price of labor there more systematically and not sustain them here with public human service programs, you see. Now, as that happens, as the attack on people go on, people mobilize, and they fight back to defend their standard of living. And as they mobilize and fight back to defend their standard of living, and as they fight back against the assault on the environment, and as they fight back against the warmongering and the militarism and the arms race and the interventionism, as they fight back against the needs of domestic, local, and global capitalism, you see, then the attack escalates not only against their standard of living, but against those very democratic rights which they are using, which they have fought for all these years, you see, which enable them to fight for more substantive things, which are the substance of democracy. And so the Supreme Court starts handing down a whole bunch of funny decisions now that apparently the right to travel is not really a constitutional right if the president has certain foreign policy considerations. That's an invitation to unlimited power. And that's a pulling back. The right to hand out leaflets, there have even been decisions on that in some courts, in some areas, prohibiting leafleting, prohibiting forms of political agitation and political organization. These are the kind of struggles we face in the future. Ladies and gentlemen, it's not that socialism threatens democracy, but that democracy threatens capitalism. That's the point. The way to oppose this onslaught, by the way, is not to lean toward the center, to cover your hide, to worry about your political respectability, especially as things are getting so much more conservative. The way, in fact, to oppose these things is to push in an ever more progressive, ever more militant direction, to generate a countervailing force. That countervailing force is the only thing that's keeping them from doing what in their heart of hearts they really want to do to us. If they really could stick it to us, you'd all be out there working for $1.10 an hour. You'd all be out there working not 8 hours, but 10 hours. They'd have it back like Taiwan and South Korea. They'd double your taxes, etc., etc. Our job is to move the center of political gravity back toward the left, back toward the interests of the many and not to the few, back toward struggles which have to do with substantive human outputs, because those substantive things are also the essence of democracy. What's the use of freedom of speech if you've got an empty belly? I think I want to close right here. And I just recall something that Rousseau, that beautiful essay he wrote called The Disquisition of the Origins of Inequality. You remember there's that passage where Rousseau uses a historical parable. He doesn't really seriously think it happened at some historical moment, but it's a parable, and it's a scene where he says, the troubles all began when that first man put those stakes in and dug a moat, and he said, this belongs to me, and you cannot come in here. And I'll let you in only to gather the fruit from those trees and give me the fruit, and I'll give you one apple or something, and work this land and give me the wealth, and you get out. And then I can use that to get more of that land and dig another moat and get more there, and you can come in a little bit, and you can have little bits of it. And Rousseau says, how many wars, how many lies, how many murders, how many crimes could have been prevented if the people had remembered that this isn't the natural way to live? That for tens of thousands of years, and there are some places still in the earth today, people don't live that way, they don't accumulate capital. The American Indian knew this when he saw the white man, and he said, the love, Sitting Bull's famous quote, the love of possessions is like a disease among them. And he looked with horror as he said, look at them. One man will own 100 horses and yet let his brother walk on bare and bleeding feet. When an Indian knew you only needed one horse or maybe two, what the hell are you going to do with 5 or 6? What do you need them for? How could you sustain them? Why would you do that to your brother when he's essential to your survival too? When people all over the world through the centuries in what was called primitive communism, understood that nobody went hungry, that there was a place at the fireplace for everyone. Unless the herd disappeared or the crops failed, then everyone shared the hunger too. And that was the way human beings and mankind lived for 1 million years before this aberration, this thing came along called capitalism. And if the people remembered that, Rousseau said, if the people would remember their heritage and they would pull up the stakes and fill in the moat and they would say, no, away with you, because the fruits of the earth belong to everyone, and the earth itself belongs to no one. But ladies and gentlemen, the earth may not belong to us, but we belong to it. It is our birthright, and we must struggle for it. And that struggle is our fulfillment. That's part of our human nature and our human transformation, you see. And it's not only that we must love social justice more than we love personal gain, but we discover that the greatest personal gain comes in the struggle for social justice. And we best experience our own personal humanity when we stand close to all of humanity.
You were just listening to Michael Parenti on capitalism. He spoke at the University of Colorado at Boulder in 1984. Michael Parenti was a leading independent political analyst, scholar, and author. He's the author of numerous books, including Against Empire. He passed away on January 24th at the age of 92. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. From its early days, Michael Parenti was an integral part of Alternative Radio, with more than 40 programs in our Parenti archive. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Michael Parenti on Capitalism, and for his classic book, Against Empire, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
This is Bird Noir. I'm Michael Stein, Private Eye. My buddy Frank's my eyes and ears in the neighborhood. He knows everyone and their business. He called me the other day to report some suspicious behavior.
Michael, some bird is trying to pull the wool over my eyes. I keep hearing a red-shouldered hawk in the shrubs outside my window, but there ain't no hawk in sight. You hear that? Who does this raptor imposter think he is?
Frankie, you know them hawks are usually perched up higher, soaring around looking for prey. So I'll bet my bottom dollar that you're dealing with a mimic. Can you see any signs of a northern mockingbird? Gray body with striking black and white marks on its wings and tail?
No dice.
Maybe a brown thrasher. A robin-sized bird with brown streaks on its breast and a long bill?
That's another swing and a miss.
Well, Frankie, what birds do you see?
Just the usuals. Some robins, a couple of sparrows. One of those chatty blue jays.
That's a culprit, Frankie. Though they don't have the same reputation for mimicry as mockingbirds and thrashers, blue jays have an unnerving habit of impersonating raptors, especially red-shouldered hawks.
Wow, who'da thunk?
Learn how to solve your own bird mysteries on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Private Eye, Michael Stein. Broadcast.